Okay, good. Welcome to the commanding heights of Clement House, the seventh floor. And indeed, welcome to the Global South Unit's first speaker for its Latin America-China program this year. This is an inaugural event. We're very pleased that you're all here. This is an opportunity to discuss a South-South relationship in its deeper manifestations. I'm very pleased to be able to introduce the speaker, Professor Adriana Abdener, who is a fellow at the Institute Agarape, close enough, and a graduate of both Princeton and a PhD at Princeton and Harvard, and known to me through work that we've done collectively over BRICS questions, IBSA, in South Africa primarily, but also in Brazil. So, and a well-published scholar who's done some very innovative work on questions of security, Brazilian foreign policy in that regard, and asked some big questions, which will, I think, feature in the kind of presentation she'll give us today. Serving as a discussant is Professor Marco Vieira, who from Birmingham University. He tells me he didn't vote to leave, but we will check this in the question and answer period. But he will serve as a discussant for Adriana, and also known as someone who's written on the South. I've collaborated with him on a couple of pieces as well. So both very appropriate individuals. While you're doing this, we want you to consider both looking up the Latin America China program and the publications in the Global South Unit, and also to follow us on the Twitter, which the information is there. So that's all for you. I don't multitask, so I just tend to look and listen to the speaker, but all of you guys can follow these things that way. Adriana will speak for between 30, 40 minutes or so, and then Marco will make some reflections upon that, and then we'll open up to all of you for your questions. Yes, and the title is, of course, Rooted versus Mechanical Dependency, China and Latin America's Extractive Sector. Adriana.
Better than sitting down. So thank you very much. Thanks to Professor Alden and the Global South Unit for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be back in London. And I have to say that being here at LSE has, for me, a very special meaning, because circa 1999, I applied to be a postgraduate student here. And I was roundly rejected. And my father studied economics here, and he had said to me, oh, you know, I would be so proud if you went to LSE. To get that phone call, you know, and connect to my past would be wonderful. So, of course, this morning I called them, and I said, I'm calling from LSE. It only took me 17 years. Anyway, you know, I ended up going to graduate school much later, because at that time I had really no sense of what I wanted to do. But let me start then by providing a little bit of context on this particular idea and how I'm going to frame it. The idea of playing with dependence and dependency in the context of Latin America came out of a very recent project of which I was part, led by Gilles Carbonnier at the Graduate Institute, and which yielded a first paper. It's coming out in Journal of Development Policy. And what I do there is I look at China and the Latin American extractive sector, and in the ways in which investments have morphed over time from primarily greenfield projects to joint ventures and now more recently mergers and acquisitions, and what this means for China's presence in the sector. But what I'd like to do now is to reflect a little bit on, and maybe I should start with an anecdote, because when I was in Geneva last time for the final workshop of this project, I was sitting next to Teotônio dos Santos. And those of you who have studied dependency theory have probably come across his name, because he's one of the scholars, he's a Brazilian economist, who in the 1960s really helped to formulate this set of perspectives that we call dependency theory. And of course, he's a little bit older than he was in the 1960s. And he's a very funny guy, has a great sense of humor. And so he said to me, you know, I went a few decades without that many invitations, and now I get invited everywhere. I have become this rock star, because the idea of dependency, or at least the word, it has come up so often, especially with reference to South-South cooperation, right? So different connotations, but it's almost like these museum pieces of concepts are being revived. And it's not just dependency. Of course, modernization also recurs. I was just talking to my friend Emma Motsley from Cambridge. She was mentioning how in China now there's a lot of talk about modernization theory, and maybe we can begin to speak of a Chinese-style modernization theory. So what I'd like to do in terms of argument is to propose, and I'm still toying with this idea, so this is for me an occasion to also reflect and try to move forward on this, that conceptually what's going on in Latin America, and by the way, I'm going to focus on the case of Brazil, because Brazil's a little bit of an outlier in some respects. It's quite different in terms of how its extractive sector is structured, and also the size of the role that this plays in the national economy when you compare it, for instance, with Peru, with Chile, with Venezuela. And I'll explain that a little bit. But what I think conceptually there has been an ahistorical appropriation of the concept by several groups within Brazil. And thus, we encounter a need to really refine and try to maybe not abandon it, but to differentiate what is relevant about dependency in the contemporary context, in Latin America, perhaps in Africa as well, and from the way that the debates about dependency emerged, especially in the 1960s and early 70s. And then on the specific case of Brazil, which I'll address in the second half of the talk, especially with resource extraction, the claims of dependency on China, which are starting to mushroom all over the place in political debates, but also civil society debates, are clearly overblown. And I'll give you several reasons for why I think this is the case. But this might change. And I think that the possible change has to do less with internal uncertainty and policy options than with the very broad geopolitical and geoeconomic realignments that are taking place right now. So that's how I'll try to close the talk. So the first part is really conceptual, trying to link it to resource extraction, and then I'll go into the case of Brazil. So let me start by giving you a few examples of how the discourse of dependency is being mobilized. And these are all quite recent. The first one is a think tank piece. The title is Bilateral Relations Between Brazil and China, Symbiosis or Neocolonialism. And those of you who study China and Africa, this should ring a bell, because it's the kind of debate that's also been present for quite a while in terms of China's South-South cooperation with Africa. The second example is a blog post by an academic of some standing, and it's called China, Latin America, the New Axis of Dependency. And this paper is particularly interesting to me because what the author does is he draws parallels between Brazil and other South American states, especially those in which China has a very visible presence, especially in mining. And the author notes with great alarm that the Chinese government has been inviting, for instance, members of the Bolivian government for training in Beijing. And he writes, in the long term, what influences will the Chinese expansionist policy in the world market of ideas and values have on Latin America? Right? So he goes beyond sort of the political economy narrowly writ, beyond the trade and investment, and he's trying to get at this topic, which was very dear to some of the original dependency theorists, of the idea of co-optation of the ruling elites in the global periphery, right? So that they become sort of conniving with the grand project of an exploitative economic system. And it's interesting to note that certainly in the case of Brazil, this kind of mobilization or appropriation of the dependency discourse is not exclusive to one end of the political spectrum. You see people on the left and on, you know, what was the opposition to the Workers' Party and is now sort of in power, at least as an interim government, talking about dependency. So what do they mean when they mobilize this discourse? For the conservatives, what generally tends to happen is that they argue that Brazil needs not only to intensify its international trade, but to really diversify, especially, and you see this debate is going on right now, by flexibilizing Mercosur, because Brazil's foreign trade has been tied to Mercosur, right? Which is, we think of generally as an economic kind of arrangement, but it's a deeply political project that also has to do with Brazil and Argentina's bilateral efforts, very successful efforts to overcome their historic rivalry, right? It's very easy to forget, I always like to state this fact, that Brazil and Argentina both had nuclear weapon programs, and they were able to bilaterally and voluntarily let go of those programs, right? They dismantled their programs. And Mercosur arises out of that, right? Which is why I come back to this point that it's also a deeply political project. And why this idea of flexibilizing Mercosur so as to diversify trade, make it more Brazil more agile on the bilateral trade scene creates a lot of controversy. But at the same time, the nationalist leftist groups in Brazil also resort to the language of dependency. And they do so, for instance, with reference to the opening up or proposals to further open up the mining and oil sectors in Brazil, very highly regulated. And they see that, for instance, interest on the part of Chinese companies, and these are especially the major state-owned Chinese companies that act in Latin American resource sector, they see them as potentially threatening national interests. So this revival of the language of dependency, you know, is not exclusive to a political group, and I think that's very, very intriguing. And I should note, and I found this this morning, by the way, I became curious. I said, I wonder what's being said about dependency here in the UK, and I found an article from March 2012 by Jonathan Glenny and Nora Hassanian, and in the Guardian, and this is the first sentence of their piece. There are two words guaranteed to get you escorted out of most development agencies or sidelined in current development debates. They are dependency theory. Okay. And in fact, when I told my colleagues in Brazil that I was coming here and I told them the title of my talk, they said, are you sure you want to, you know, open that that Pandora's box? But obviously, I'm not the only one, and I'm very, very interested in how what kinds of meanings are being attributed and what kinds of political purposes are behind the uses of this language. So forgive me, I'm going to do a very quick refresher of dependency theory, assuming that not everybody in the room has been rereading this literature recently. But very briefly, you will recall that dependency theory is a set of different perspectives arose in large part as a reaction to modernization theory. Right? And so modernization theory posited essentially that countries could, right, it's an essentially optimistic perspective, they could progress through different stages of development all the way from backwards to modern by doing what? By emulating the path supposedly taken by the now industrialized countries. Right? So the basic assumption here is that it's doable, everybody can do it, and that the units of analysis in this case, right, the states, are independent from each other. And all they have to do is follow a little recipe. So for instance, if you have read Rostow's Stages of Modernization, you have read this little recipe, right, of how you go about doing this. By the way, it's interesting to note that Rostow and some of the other modernization theories, they cast the language of their perspective in a highly technocratic language. You know, and Rostow's booklet does so, but if you look at the subtitle, what's the subtitle of the Stages of Development? Does anybody remember?
The Non-Communist Manifesto.
The Anti-Communist Manifesto, right? So again, it's a deeply political project that comes out of a set of assumptions. So dependency theory adopts a very political lens overtly, right, as well as economic language. We have to remember that dependency theory was proposed, or theories, if you like, were proposed by social scientists that were very kind of interdisciplinary. And I think it was André Gouderfranc who very curiously studied with Milton Friedman and then rebelled against that school of economics because he went to Chile, but unlike the rest of Friedman's team, he worked for Allende, and he started seeing things a little bit differently. So a reaction to modernization theory, right, that focuses on what they perceive to be missing in this recipe booklet for development, which is a deep and a historical analysis of relations of power, right? So the idea is that there's been actually a lot of continuity between imperialism and colonialism and the post-colonial period, right? And a recasting of institutions and the logic, however, is that of exploitation. And it's not just exploitation within sort of the world system, it's an exploitation that happens at a multi-scalar, right, levels, and that is actively reproduced at these different levels. So it addresses the uneven starting points that are neglected in modernization theory, but also the structural unfairness of global capitalism. And Raoul Prebisch, the economist, posited sort of the seed of the idea really was that the prosperity that you saw in the industrialized world actually happened at the expense of the global periphery, right? And so these things were linked rather than occurring independently. Now, of course, other social scientists built on this idea by stating that the impoverishment of the periphery is not just inherent to the system, but it's actually by design, the desirable means to an end, which is wealth in the core, desirable, of course, from the perspective of those in the core. And resource extraction was really important to most of these strands of dependency theory. And in the active production of underdevelopment, right? So this is very important. The idea that underdevelopment is not a default state, but rather is something that is actively produced and reproduced. Why? Because it entails generally highly exploitative relations of labor for the siphoning off. In Portuguese, we call it escoamento. Escoamento is literally the draining, right, of wealth, of resources, for the prosperity of the global core. And you see this too, for instance, in how they write about, and again, this comes back to the fore with full force, about infrastructure and the fact that during the colonial times, whatever infrastructure was put in place in much of Latin America was meant precisely to drain these resources, whether it was gold and later on iron ore or coal or copper and zinc, depending on where you're talking about, right? So that there were physical, spatial patterns that were associated with these relations of power and this idea of escoamento, right? So Cardoso, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who wrote with Faletto on this, they made this idea quite clearly. And one very important message that comes out of this literature that is, I think, particularly relevant, especially since Thomas Piketty published his book and triggered another wave of debate, is the idea that it's not just inequality, it's not just poverty, but also inequality. And inequality not just between the state units, but within them as well, that is behind the way that the system works. And so this is a real different a real point of difference with respect to modernization theory, right? The fact, for instance, that it's not just about the core and the periphery, but that the ruling elites in the periphery, they have cultural reference points that are more aligned, according to the theory, with the core than with the rest of the country. And so, for instance, in Brazil, the elites used to send their children to study in Portugal and France, later in the United States. I'm an example of that. I went to the United States to study, to the UK. I imagine that we have also some Brazilians here. So there was also a cultural element of almost like a cultural hegemony that meant that the kind of dependency that was described and analyzed by those theories was deeply rooted. And I use this word very consciously to mean that the relations of power that they were describing were not just imposed, but they were internalized by those local, the ruling elites, who then actively helped to actively reproduce those hierarchies and inequalities and really benefited from them. And therefore, and this is why the dependency theory, I think there's part of the reason why it fell out of favor, it's that it's a deeply pessimistic set of theories. There were some of them who prescribed delinking from the global economy as the only solution, but for the most part, they didn't seem to, and Cardozo and Faletto are kind of guilty of this, that you know, what is really the solution? These are such powerful forces. Now, there are several factors why dependency theory lost steam, even within academic debates. And the one that is mentioned the most frequently has to do with the Asian tigers, right? The Asian tigers, Japan, the tigers come along, and what they do is exactly the opposite, right? They link up, they insert themselves very strategically into the globalizing economy, especially by specializing in the export of manufacturing, of manufacturers. Of course, also making huge overhauls at home, for instance, investing massively in education and coordinating, so there's a coordination between the state and private sector and large companies. But also we have the crisis of the industrialization by import substitution model. We have the crisis, the oil crisis of 73, and then the aftermath and with all of the indebtedness. And in fact, there was an article in Carta Capital. Carta Capital in Brazil is a publication that's very closely associated with the Workers' Party, the left generally, in which they lament the 40th anniversary of dependency theory because, and I quote and translate, the ideas have all been but forgotten, and we need to bring them back. So this was a mini manifesto that came out of Carta Capital in 2012. Right. So poor Teotônio went a few decades without getting so many international invitations. So at the same time, though, the language of dependency is deeply rooted within Brazilian society. And here are some of the elements that I found, right, to explain why it's being brought back with such force. The first one is that a lot of the social scientists behind the original wave of dependency theory were Brazilian. So you might know some of them, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who then became president, writing with Faletto, Celso Furtado, Teotônio dos Santos, I've already mentioned, Vânia Bambirra. Yeah. So there were lots of them. And Celso Furtado has passed away, but even he remains actually quite influential through a think tank and through his publications. There are also institutions and political groups in Brazil that espouse developmentalism. And even though developmentalism is not the same thing as dependency theory, there's often a kind of confluence or even an exaggeration or confusion between these schools of thought with an emphasis, heavier emphasis on the role of the state as a guiding force in developmentalism, right, and looking towards the Asian experiences as a point of reference. But
what I think there was something else that allows the language of dependency to come back, that was already there, kind of floating about. And it has to do with this. In English, you draw a distinction between dependence and dependency. You have two words. Sometimes they get conflated, right? People use them interchangeably. But they don't necessarily refer to the same thing. So there is a 1978 special issue of International Organization on that draws this distinction, and the introduction by James Caporano, I think, makes it very clear, a clear proposal for making the separation more clear. Dependence refers to external reliance on other actors. It usually starts with a premise of liberalism, and the basic unit of analysis is the nation states. Okay, so it has nothing to do with dependency theory. Dependency is this that I was describing, the process of incorporation of less developed countries into a very hierarchical global capitalist system and all of the distortions that it implies. So the unit of analysis, again, is multiscalar, right, with dependency, and you have to look at the interlinkages between the domestic and the international as relations of power. So part of the explanation that I've come up with for this resurgence of the language of dependencia, right, which is only one word, is its ambiguity. And in particularly in Portuguese and Spanish, right, this distinction is not as easy to make because of the semantic ambiguity. So, okay, you know, covered a little bit of dependency theory and the ways that it has seemed to re-emerge, right, out of its latent but not entirely dead state, at least in Brazil. What does this have to do then with China and Brazil? Now, China, as you may know, has been Brazil's top trading partner since 2009, when it overtook mostly Western states. And I think there are four impressive aspects to this. And this, you know, you could say the same thing, I think, of China elsewhere in Latin America. The first one is the sheer scale of these exchanges, right? It's just massive trade. The second one has to do with, and sometimes this is overlooked, the sheer speed with which China became so relevant to Brazil, right? Or the rest of Latin America. We were talking earlier, in the case of Peru, I think there was engagement with investments earlier. In Brazil, it's very recent. It's basically a five-year story. There was some pioneering action, but it all, both trade and especially investments, are very, very recent, and they're increasing quite fast. The third point has to do with asymmetry. But here, in the case of Brazil at least, we have to be very careful when we talk about asymmetry between China and Brazil. Because, yes, on the one hand, it's true that the composition of trade is very imbalanced, right? It's the story of Chinese trade almost everywhere. They export manufacturers. They've been trying to increase the value added of these manufacturers, and you see that reflected in the products that arrive in Brazil. And in the meantime, Brazil exports soybeans and iron ore, right? And a few other commodities and very, very few semi-manufactured things. And the fourth point that's very relevant for Brazil specifically within the context of Latin America is the competition that China represents for Brazilian exports of manufacturers, which traditionally have been strong within the Mercosur area and in Latin America, and the secondary plane in Africa, right? And this will then fuel incipient discourses of Chinese threat, but with respect to the displacement of Brazilian exports elsewhere in the so-called global south. When we look specifically at the Brazilian extractive sector, then China is relevant in a number of ways. The most visible role of China is as a buyer of commodities, especially iron ore. Right? And iron ore, of course, is combined with coal for steel production, so when we see China building massively, right, that explains the skyrocketing demand for iron ore and Brazilian iron ore. And it's interesting to note that in the aftermath of the financial and economic crisis that began around 2008, when China implemented a stimulus package, this was highly beneficial to the Brazilian economy, particularly because so much of that stimulus package was geared towards investments in infrastructure, right, which increases then the demand for metal inputs. And so, and you see this reflected, and I think it helped to offset some of the decline in prices in iron. The second way in which China is very relevant to the extractive sector in Brazil is less apparent. But when you think about it, China is a driver of Brazilian internationalization. For instance, Vale, right, the world's, I think it's still the world's biggest producer of iron ore, but it's not doing very well. Vale went to Africa, right, massively in the 2000s and set up shop in several African countries with some major investments. For instance, in Mozambique, right, in an attempt to expand coal production. That coal production was destined to China, okay? And when you look at the plans that Vale was drawing up, and I say was because things have changed, they were clearly in response, you know, very agile response to the changing China market. So coal and iron ore, the coal, not in un-Brazilian soil, but this involvement was then fomented, at least for now, and during that period, by Chinese demand. The third relevance of China to the Brazilian extractive sector has to do with oil and gas, and especially the pre-salt oil. So we, around 2006, the Brazilian government and Petrobras, the state-affiliated oil company, announced the discovery of these huge reserves of oil in the pre-salt layer off the coast of especially southeastern Brazil, right? And this was very important to the imaginary of the Brazilian future. Right now, things are a little bit shaky, as with everything in Brazil. But what happened is that the Workers' Party-led government under Lula and then under Dilma decided to open up bits of the bidding process to foreign companies as long as they joined consortia, right? So Chinese companies joined some of the consortia in the first auction for pre-salt oil. It's seen a very historic moment. And let me tell you a little interesting anecdote. On the day that the auction began, I was in the port in Rio de Janeiro, and there were three Chinese warships docked. The port in Rio is adjacent to the old part of town, which is now being revitalized or gentrified. And they were fully weaponized warships. And this didn't make the media. It still astonishes me. But the Chinese consulate invited me to visit. I took a few students. We have there are pictures of them on Facebook. So, and finally, China's very important because it's a promise maker, right? And this is also true in the rest of Latin America. So Chinese companies and the government periodically, especially over the last 5 years, they come to Brazil and they make huge promises of investments, either broad flows or even specific investments, especially in sort of mega projects, right, that will alter the landscape of soy production or of coal production or of iron ore mining in the case of Brazil. But it's also very important to highlight that, as I said before, Brazil is a bit of an outlier in some respects when you look at the Latin American extractive industries. First of all, even though Brazil markets itself as a superpower of commodities exports, and it is very important, yeah, it's a food basket of the world already, Brazil is a very closed economy, very, very closed economy. Its industrial and services sectors are also play a large role. It's not just agriculture. But when you look at traditional macro-level measures of, for instance, trade penetration, share of exports and imports in GDP, Brazil is an unusually closed outlier, even for an economy of its size. Sometimes you hear, why is it that Brazil is so closed? Well, it has to do with the sheer scale of its economy. But when you look at economies around the world that are more or less its size, the figures are really attention-catching. So, for instance, The trade to GDP ratio in 2013 for Brazil was 27.6%. That's a figure that was among the lowest in the world. And to give you a comparative sense, Brazil trade openness compared to that of the other BRICS countries, they have trade to GDP, at least they did in 2013, of around 50%. You know, so this is a real mismatch between the image that a lot of people have, Brazil's being this trade ace, and the actual importance of this trade to the Brazilian economy. The second point of difference is that Chinese investments in resource extraction in Brazil look very different from most of the rest of Latin America. Why? Because you don't have a lot of greenfield projects. For instance, in mining, you don't have open pit mines where Chinese companies come in with or without state financing, as they have done, for instance, in Peru, in Chile. Instead, what you have is a few joint ventures, and I mentioned these big consortia where Chinese companies are still in the minority. And these consortia often bear the names of the companies, you know, Repsol or, you know, Western companies. They change ownership so often that sometimes it's actually hard to keep track. But I think it's very interesting that Chinese names and Chinese companies' names, they're not so visible, and that Chinese capital enters and begins to enter the Brazilian extractive sector through these less visible ways, and especially now when mergers and acquisitions have become the predominant way in which Chinese capital enters the Brazilian extractive sectors. So what you don't have, if you study, for instance, and I'm by no means an expert in the other countries, but I know that, for instance, in Peru, you've had cases of open pit mining where local communities, right, they protest, and they protest very specifically against a Chinese company or Chinese presence, right? A project in general, but China has become a specific issue, right? Sometimes it's even simplified, but it's become a very concrete part of that political debate. In Brazil, that's actually not the case. China is very abstract. I always say this to my students. This might change, but let me give you an example. Vale, right, the iron ore mining company, has a big project. So it's a 17 billion mine expansion and railway project in Carajás, which is in the north state of Pará, right, around the Amazon. This is the largest iron ore mine in the world, and it's being expanded massively. Why is it being expanded? You know, right now, it's still due to primarily Chinese demand, but there's no association made and no attribution of, you know, of guilt. I'm not saying that it should be. I'm just saying that whatever environmental debates or debates about social dislocation or the protests that happen in Carajás, and there was recently a protest with over 10,000 workers who paralyzed the railway that leading to and from the mine. You know, China is not an issue. It's something that's very abstract, sort of in the background. And so discussions even of dependency on China are still also cast in this very ambiguous language compared to other places that certainly I've come across in Latin America and in Africa. So this concept of rooted versus mechanical dependency, how am I doing on time? 10, okay, great. This is more or less less than halfway, okay. More than halfway. So this is this scenario that I've painted, and of course here in the specific case of Brazil, I think calls attention not only to these different ways in which a very abstract concept of China and Chinese stakeholders is mobilized, but also for those of us who study the influence of China in Latin America and the relations, we have to be very careful in what we mean also by the concept of dependency. And I think it's important to note, at least in the case of Brazil, that their economic interests and their economic projects, cooperation projects, investments, different negotiations of trade, of enhancing trade, trying to counter the slowdown in China. I'll come back to that in a bit. But China has made a few inroads in terms of soft power in Brazil. So, you know, there are Confucius Institutes. We see more and more Chinese language classes. We see more interest, I see more interest on the part of students, for studying China. But China is not yet a primary cultural reference point. So to the extent that there are threads of dependency emerging, I'm going to come back to that, it's not a rooted dependency. You don't have a ruling elite in Brazil that identifies more, for instance, with the interests, you know, of the Chinese Communist Party or China more broadly. The language barrier is still enormous. You know, we have more people now who are trying to learn Chinese, but that's a very, very significant obstacle for cultural exchange. We also have to remember, this is a very kind of basic distinction, but unlike the countries about which the dependency theorists were writing in the mid-20th century, China never colonized Brazil, right, or Latin America. There were historical linkages that actually go back a few centuries, even between China and Brazil. But these were not imbued with, you know, exploitative relations of power. And we get back to that issue of the timing, right? The surge in Chinese economic influence is very, very recent, particularly in the case of Brazil, which has very strong regulatory frameworks in place compared to these other countries. And so that also is very relevant insofar as dependency theory also focused on these continuities, right, which post-colonialism, of course, also takes up. The second point that I think we also have to keep in mind, and that raises all kinds of interesting issues and questions, it is the fact that Brazil does abroad some of the same things that China does in Brazil, right? Globalization is no longer a north-south phenomenon, narrowly put. I already mentioned that Vale, for instance, the metals company, has gone to several places in Africa. They've since retracted the role, partly because of the falling prices. But a lot of Brazilian transnational corporations, I should say Brazil-based transnational corporations, in the construction industry, and who have quite a bit of expertise in implementing resource-related infrastructure like roads that lead to the mines and so forth. And they've been very active, not just in Lusophone Africa, for instance, but when you look all around, practically almost all of the South American countries that have borders with Brazil had or have major infrastructure projects being carried out by these Brazilian companies. So what does it mean? And can we really speak of dependency when a country has both state and non-state actors that are actively engaged in these investments, in these trade relationships that themselves imply relations of asymmetrical relations of power? Right? And in fact, some of these companies have been objects of protests in Africa due to labor practices, due to environmental impact, because they don't follow the same environmental standards that are required by Brazilian legislation, which are still very weak, but they're something, right? So they go abroad, and these are not the practices. And the fact that many of these companies, Petrobras, which had investments, very untransparent investments, for instance, in Angola, or the construction companies, or the Brecht, Andrade Gutierrez, and others, often had financing from the Brazilian National Development Bank, right? So the government has had in place, now this is starting to be rethought, I think, to some extent. We have to watch the story, but a national champions policy. So the idea was to invest heavily in the companies that already had scale, and that already had expertise, for instance, in resource-related infrastructure implementation, and to bet on that scale for the internationalization of Brazilian companies. So this means that we have circularities of capital that are actually much more complex than what was described, what was in place, right? In the 1960s, you have to remember that that was sort of before the surge in globalization of the 1970s and 80s. So it's not just the Brazilian context that has changed and the Chinese context that has changed, but the entire global trade, global economy context. And that certainly was not foreseen by the original dependency theorists. Now, of course, everything that I've been telling you was based on what was happening until more or less last year, certainly in the case of Brazil. And I've given a few talks on different topics over the last 2 months. I was just telling Marco, it's just impossible to escape the topic of what's going on in Brazil. Right? But when you talk about Brazil and China, you have to talk about new sources of uncertainty on both ends. And probably very familiar with the story of China's economic transition. So you have deceleration already happening. You have a degree of acceptance of a controlled, hopefully controlled deceleration by the Chinese leadership and the recognition that there is a need to rebalance the economy in several ways. For instance, by boosting the participation of domestic consumption and of the services sector. Right. So we've had speeches by Chinese leaders. We have at least the last two, I think, five-year plans. They try to spell out this need to have maintain growth, but at somewhat lower rates, certainly not the double-digit rates that happened for, I think, was it 17 consecutive years, but with a more sustainable profile, right? And so that generates a lot of uncertainty for Brazilian actors in the extractive sector. Okay, perfect. Because patterns of demand will change, right? And that has to do not only with the transition that's being planned for the Chinese development model, but also the way that its investments abroad are being rethought. So for instance, the One Belt, One Road initiative, for the main players in the Brazilian extractive sector, that is a story that they're already very eager to follow because they hope that this will maybe reconfigure the space of Chinese fomented demand for metals, right? Away from other places, other regions, away maybe from China itself, but maybe there'll be new pockets created around Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and interlinking Russia and India all the way to, well, the grand prize, I think, in that project, I understand to be Europe, right? But anyway, so there is a lot of uncertainty on the Chinese side for Brazilian actors. And of course, for Brazil right now, we're living in a moment of extreme uncertainty, political, economic, and I'm not going to go into details because I'm wrapping up, but it affects the extractive sector very, very directly. The Lava Jato, which is the series of operations and here I have to be very careful with the language to maintain some sort of balance, to root out corruption, right? And the other another side argues that it's a very politicized move that was against the Workers' Party predominantly. But they have affected all of these companies that I mentioned. Petrobras and the construction companies are under investigation. Their directors, many of them are actually in prison, which is unprecedented in Brazil. So we don't know, you know, as I said, BNDES, the National Development Bank, and its role in fomenting exports and financing exports is being rethought. They brought in a new leader for the institution, who has a very different profile, and there'll probably be some deep rethinking of this kind of financing. So, in conclusion, again, we need to make, I think, conceptual differentiations, and I'm just here toying with some of these ideas of a rooted kind of dependency that is across the board, is multi-sectorial, and that's also ingrained even in at the individual level, especially by the ruling elites, whereby they connive. You know, I don't know if that's the right word, but their interests are more aligned with that of the center. And on the other hand, the language that I'm proposing to describe the threads of dependency that we actually may see is that of mechanical, where there are investments, there's trade, and it's not that this is devoid of power relations, but it's very different from the kind of multidimensional political, cultural rootedness that the dependency theorists analyzed in the 1960s. So in bringing back these, you know, these conceptual museum pieces, it's very important for us to analyze the ways in which this language is mobilized, but also I think as analysts of South-South cooperation, the way that we use these as and maybe adapt them as frameworks for analysis. And I think I'll stop there then. And I look forward to your input and your questions as I play around with these ideas.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Adriana, for your presentation. I really enjoyed your presentation. Also, I had the opportunity to read some of your notes beforehand. I should admit that the task of discussing your presentation is not an easy one, mainly because I mostly agree with everything you said. And I also think your distinction between rooted and mechanical patterns of dependency, to look at the work of China and dependency as has been theorized in the past, is really, really interesting. And I think you found something really fruitful in terms of looking at those differences between old and new patterns of dependency. I do have four or five points I'd like to raise. They are not really well structured, but I think we might trigger some discussion. And also, I not want to be in between the audience and the presenter. I'm sure you're keen to ask questions as well. I'll keep it short. So the first point I'd like to make is, and this was an issue that kept me thinking, is this distinction between rooted and mechanical. Because if you look back to dependency theory as it has been established, this is a structural take on the international economic system. Basically, dependency is not related with one particular country, it's related with the international economic order. So dependency is a feature of the international economic system rather than a type of political economic project of one single state. Right, you have the core capitalist states that you can identify as the core, but in itself, what is rooted and embedded is a set of capitalist liberal norms, values, and types of relationships which are embedded in the system, not in any particular country. Obviously, the impact relates with the elites that you mentioned, but I do not see this type of direct relation that we step in the mechanical side of things with China. One seems to be structural, and the rooted side is structural, the greater dependence theory, and the other one is more like bilateral with a strong agency by one actor, in this case, China. So it's something that maybe you'd like to refine as you carry on thinking about this, because it seems to be a very interesting distinction. The second point is a more general point, not only related with your presentation, but with the whole idea of the role of China in Latin America. I was glad that you focused on Brazil, because it seems to me that it can be slightly misleading to look at China in Latin America, when in fact you're looking at China relations with a number of different states who have completely or quite distinct economic, political, ideological outlooks. Right? What you have presented here is a very particular type of bilateral relationship with one Latin American country. In fact, Brazil likes to be called a South American country, not a Latin American country. In the same token, if you look at bilateral relations with Mexico, with Argentina, with Venezuela, which is a very interesting case, we may identify a more nuanced type of relationship that we can describe as more or less mechanical or more or less rooted based on a set of principles that China is trying to promote in the international system as well. So if it's something that, again, in the thing of looking at this binary or distinction between rooted and mechanical, we can also look at particular cases and how those things play out differently in each one of those countries. I thought about a particular case of Venezuela, because it seems that in Venezuela, or maybe in the Alba block, or Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, the rootedness has been more effective than in Mexico, Brazil, and at some extent Argentina, mainly now with the new governments. So this is, I like to use this conceptual framework, seems to be quite interesting, but in terms of identify different degrees in which those processes take place, looking at those different countries. Another point as well that I think was interesting is rather than look at the rooted and mechanical and link it back with dependency theory, it seems interesting as well is whether China is promoting a new consensus, you know, a new type of state-led capitalism, which has been quite attractive, not only in Latin America, but a number of other countries who are engaging with developmental issues in Africa, Asia, Southeast Asia as well. So is, and again, less dependency theory, more maybe a new Gramscian take on a new hegemonic bloc led by China, right? Where the issue of cultural ideology plays an important role, whereas in dependency theory, the ideology is not as central, yeah, now as in a Gramscian take on how hegemonic blocs rise and fall in international relations. Maybe it'd be a good set of theories for you to engage with as well. Okay, I think I mentioned most of the things I'd like to say. Finally, in the case of Brazil, what was very interesting is this idea that China is perceived as an abstract entity, mm-hmm, right? That even when it's present, it seems to be present in the background. You know, people don't really engage with it. I'm not asking to answer this question, because why is it the case? Why is Brazil not engaging more directly in looking at China as an alternative model to development? It has to do with deep-rooted Western values that have been embedded in Brazil, or an English language. Now, I was interested about that, so there are different degrees in which those types of the presence of China happens in different countries. Even in Venezuela, because if you look at Venezuela, the Venezuelan government has been engaging with China less in terms of emulating the Chinese system, but as a way to be able to prop up its own populist fight of very, very Latin American capitalism, no? The Latin American populist model that has been enabled by the financing funding of China, less so than emulating China culture values, so on and so forth. So I have just one last point on Brazil. If you look at Brazil, and again, in this abstract entity kind of discussion, it's interesting that if one area, telecommunications, yeah, so the penetration of China is massive. So I think out of the seven 4G networks, I think China has set up six of them, Huawei, which is the main Chinese telecommunication, which has very strong links with the Chinese government. So this whole discussion about surveillance, you know, in the American side, seems quite interesting, because they seem not be worried with the penetration of China in telecommunications and the kind of security and strategic issues it can raise in the future. Brazilian government, which seems to link quite nicely with this thing of China as an abstract, almost harmless entity that we can deal with even if we don't engage fully with it. So I'll stop here just to allow quite large audience, I'm sure they want to ask questions. So thank you very much for the presentation.
I think what we'll do is we'll let. We'll take a couple of questions, and if Adriana wants to address any of the particular points as well that Marco has made, she can do so once she, in the context of responding to questions. So we'll open it up for two or three, and please identify yourself. We have here, and here, and here. We're just biased for this corner first.
Thank you. Nasser Qalawun, commentator on BBC and other Arab media satellite stations. I have 2 points, please. The first one is about the kind of hesitation of Western capital to invest in Brazil. Mm-hmm. I followed quite a few meetings between investors, especially from Germany and UK, around, and I found they asked many questions in the last few years about the Brazil being closed economy. It needs very heavy infrastructure rehabilitation, but there is inertia in matters of opening up and not letting the foreign capital to get in. This is a fact. Now, China got in, as you put it, in this space. What is the legal basis for Chinese companies' investments in Brazil? If the Western companies, they ask many questions and they let go in. The Chinese and Japanese ones, especially Mitsui, got in and they got investment. What is the legal one? That's number one. And number two, in matters of the dependency model, and I'll be brief here, how come the Chinese model has given the new middle class a new income to come to there? And from my visit to Brazil, I found the gap between the rich and poor is so huge that it's not bridged in the last 40 years as you compare to China. So is there even a way to get overcome this one?
Thank you. This, again, identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Heather from UNESP. First of all, it's really nice to see someone from Brazil lecturing a speech. So anyway, recently we saw like Dilma Rousseff government falling by impeachment, and Michel Temer is assuming her position, and he nominating a new ministry. Well, José Serra assumed the Ministry of Exterior Relations, and he's talking about like new. More trading relations with other countries, but we're actually facing a huge crisis in Brazil with lots of small and medium entrepreneurs. Bankrupting and all kinds of stuff. I would like you to give your opinion about Brazil's future economy with this new acting president and with the relations with China and other countries.
I'm Alvaro Mendes, co-founder of the Global Study. Welcome to the LSE. Very brief question. I want to talk about the Pacific. I asked recently, a few months ago, Celso Morim, what you guys thought about the Pacific Alliance, and he said emphatically he didn't like it. But things have changed for you. And I think you used to look to the Atlantic guys. And now I think, is it time for Brazil to start looking backwards a little bit, or perhaps forwards? You could argue that the Pacific is the future, especially in the light of the possible construction of a train building up, linking up Brazil to Peru for the future. That's it.
So that's it for now. Just and we'll come back to some more questions. So.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to Marco for really thought-provoking comments and also for the questions from the audience. I could go on a long time, but let me pick and choose. On the heterogeneity of Latin America, that was exactly my impulse. I told Chris that I would speak about Latin America, but simultaneously I was asked by Gil to write this paper about forms of Chinese investment, and I thought, I can't do this in just one paper, and so that's why I decided to focus on Brazil. But I think there's an analogous story maybe to the scholarship on China and Africa, where you see earlier waves of this literature treating the continent as a whole, and then I think there's been quite a learning process, and so a lot of the recent literature, including that produced by Chris and his students and former students, get very nuanced, right? And you see how different institutional frameworks and regulatory frameworks, they interact with the learning process on the Chinese side to produce very different outcomes, for instance, in the African extractive industry. So it's very wrong now to speak about the same levels of Chinese labor being brought in. There are countries that are able to leverage their bargaining power, right, and really negotiate, whether you're talking about extractive sector or others. And I think that the literature on China and Latin America, I'm going to be harsh here, but I think, and I've contributed towards this, I think, until recently, it's been very redundant and it's been very oversimplifying, because it only now, I think, has it started to look at case studies and look how things really vary on the ground. And there's, you may know this, there's excellent work being done. I think Cynthia Sanborn, is she coming?
She's coming.
Yeah, so, I mean, the work that Cynthia is doing is absolutely fantastic, and it really gets at the nitty-gritty of individual projects. And I think she's been working with the folks in Boston as well and elsewhere. So I think the next few years are really exciting, and the timing of the launch of this Latin America program is absolutely perfect because there's a lot of engagement. I think in Brazil we're actually lagging behind. You know, I see our Peruvian counterparts and our Chilean counterparts moving full ahead. It's very part of the split down the middle of South America. On the invisibility of China or the abstractness of China in Brazil, again, I think it has to do with the modalities of investment and especially the tendency to go very cautiously through consortia and through joint ventures that maintain the non-Chinese name of the actors. I think that's partly by design, because they've learned, the Chinese companies have learned elsewhere. Sometimes it's best to keep a low profile, at least while you prospect and you explore and you get acquainted with the practices of a particular country. But another factor is that in Brazil, we don't have a large Chinese diaspora community. It's expanding, but it's nowhere close to what you see even in a lot of cities in African countries. And that might change because we have flows, but I think that helps to make, you know, China, gives China more of a face, right? When you have these communities be very active, at least very present. Moving to some of the questions. So Nasser from BBC, there's many barriers to investing in Brazil. Vast literature about this, but we often speak of custo Brasil, right, the Brazil cost. We speak of it half jokingly, mostly not joking, crying, because the cost of everything, partly due to regulation, is really, really high. So I know that a lot of the Western companies who have in the past tried to invest, the cost effectiveness is not in place. And ironically, in part, this has to do with the lack of infrastructure, but also the lack of action and maybe willpower to reform some aspects of that regulatory system. There are very strong labor interests that are in place in the extractive sector. That's certainly true. And then that makes it very difficult for whatever government is in power. And that includes the Lula government and the Dilma government. They made big promises about how they were going to attract more investments, and they're going to, for instance, build up the ports and the export-oriented infrastructure, and actually very little happened. And that had to do not only with the hesitation of foreign stakeholders, but also the slowness and the sort of the political dynamics around around investments. China is often willing to take on greater risks. And you see this elsewhere in Latin America as well, in South America certainly. They have strategies for prospection in different sectors. In the extractive sector, I think the mergers and acquisition is the latest manifestation of this. But they also have the scale of their financing. I think that it's not true that they're willing to take any risks, so they're watching very, very closely. I've spoken to friends at Huawei recently. I've spoken to friends in the oil industry, Chinese friends, and you know, they watch very, very closely. But you know, it's as in much of Africa, it's a Western, some Western actors really ignored the potential in some of the African economies, and China barged right in with a lot of financing. So you see this, I think, on a much more reduced scale right now in South America. Renan from UNESP, okay, so this is kind of a big question, but so yes, under the Temer interim government, the present foreign minister has been tasked with focusing on trade and as a partial solution to the economic crisis, right? Partial because the other aspect is supposedly the implementation of these reforms that are politically very difficult to push through. But it's very hard to know what will happen because the first, the way I see it, you know, the first announcements, I mean, there's like at a discursive level, you know, this is about change. But when you look at what's been happening over the past month, you know, there aren't that, there's a discourse of austerity, but the expenses of the government are still very high. At some level, you know, I think there will be a reckoning. And either the government is going to have to choose one direction. If you look at the profile of the individuals that they have chosen to lead their economic team, they have a different orientation for the most part. So I think there will be some changes, but for now it's kind of what calls attention is actually continuity in terms of the cargos comissionados and cargos de confiança. So there's a lot of talk about reducing the size of the state, but when you look at what they've been doing the last month, it's, you know, it's just replacement rather than reduction. I'm not making a value judgment, I'm just describing what I see. Andres, on the Pacific Alliance, yeah, I bet Amorim is not very happy with it. I think there's a sense, and Itamaraty, the ministry, has had several discussions about trade. Civil society is also starting to launch a deeper conversation about Brazil's place in the world. And in fact, there was a whole section that I didn't get to because of time constraints. But my view is that you have these very broad geopolitical and geoeconomic alignments. You have the TPP, right, and the Alianza Pacifica links up to that. You have the possibility of a transatlantic partnership. You have new sub-regional arrangements that on the surface seem to have nothing to do with Brazil, but actually they will have very deep repercussions for the extractive sector, among others. So for instance, RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is being slowly coming to fruition in Asia, and might be more China-led now that TPP is being implemented. I mean, that's my guess, is that as a reaction to TPP, China might become more of a leader in RCEP. Brazil's out of all of this. All of it. I mean, even China, that's nominally out of TPP, is watching very closely, and there have been statements by Chinese officials in the sense that there is interest there, maybe some point in the future, engaging deeply. I don't know, I haven't been following that closely. Brazil is really isolated at the moment. It has Mercosur. There's this incipient talk of flexibilização, so making Mercosur more flexible. As I mentioned early in my talk, there are groups that will resist this very fiercely, and I think it has to do with the political significance of Mercosur, which sometimes gets subsumed in these discussions of trade. You know, if you think, I always come back to this fact that we had nuclear weapons programs. You know, they were parallel, they were secretive, but they were full steam ahead, especially on the Argentina side, but on the Brazil side too, by the military. And we were able to dismantle that, so I think that cannot be underestimated. And there are groups, including within Itamaraty, where this story is very deeply inculcated in the training of our young diplomats, that Mercosur has more than a symbolic political value. But let me tell you an anecdote. In the recent debate that was organized in Brasilia by the ministry with members of organized civil society, some academics, we have a specialist who's at Fundação Getúlio Vargas in São Paulo, Vera Tostan. She's very well known in Brazil, and she became a specialist in negotiations through the World Trade Organization. Brazil has invested, right, very heavily politically and in its multilateral strategy. And Vera has created some really innovative programs in Sao Paulo that train not just the diplomats, but for instance, lawyers who work with trade negotiation. And so they're accustomed to this whole normative framework and even this language. And at this event, Vera turned to us and she said, you know, I spent carnival break reading the text of the TPP, which is very Vera-like commented. I am so worried because this, on the surface, seems to have some continuity with what the World Trade Organization does in some areas, but it's come up with a whole new language. It really is more than just trade. It's this whole new language. And the models of negotiation that Brazil has actually become very adept at negotiating the trade disagreements, for instance. She said, we have to throw that out the window, and we don't know where we are. So there's a sense in Brasilia, I don't know if it's changed over the last couple of weeks, that Brazil is between, what is the expression, a rock and a hard place. Because you have the Aliança Pacífica moving full steam ahead. For some, Amorim doesn't like it, but others view it as maybe a model, you know, that if Brazil needs more scale, so if, you know, if there could be an effective coordination within Mercosur, then it would have more political leverage. But there's a lot of concern that South America in particular is being sort of split down the middle. Brazil can't just look towards Africa. I mean, it's important to maintain at some level the South-South cooperation with Africa. But, you know, the response has been to look towards Europe. And the uncertainty coming out of Europe has just been enhanced by Brexit. Right? So I don't know what the specific repercussions are, but the sense that I can relay to you from my impressions of being in Brasilia repeatedly and talking about this is that people don't know exactly what to do. You know, they're testing different strategies, but there's no grand strategy for Brazilian trade. And so I think relations with China on the commercial side are sort of on automatic pilot. But I don't see, as of now, a strategic vision of how to enhance negotiations or you know, how to deal with it in the mid to long term with all of these changes in the Chinese economy.
Great. We have time for another set of three questions. I'm not going to look at this side. Let's look at this side. Gentleman in the yellow, yourself in front, and then is there anyone else over here? The woman over there. Yeah.
My name is Ariel. I work in capital markets in Argentina, and I would like to know your opinion about their relation of power with China and Argentina specifically, because Argentina was a bubble closed for almost 10 years. Now we are opening to the financial world. Our president says last week that even China could put $20 billion that they needed for the financing this new project. They don't want to only close the deal with China because they are afraid of what it might cost. We gave visas to Chinese people, like now they can't get inside without visas.
The visa policy changed?
Yes, they changed the visa policy. I don't know what might happen, or if you have like an opinion, might happen like similar to Brazil or to Peru, which is
okay.
Lovely presentation, thank you. I'm Rahul Birkbeck, student, just crashing at LSE party. I wondered if you could speak on the dependency from the Brazilian perspective amongst its own neighbors in the north. You know, I know you talk about outliers, but Guyana, Suriname, resource endowment, but very underdeveloped, as well as the relationship between Brazil and its kind of cultural Lusophone African, Angolas, Mozambiques. You know, from my understanding, you still can't fly from Brazil to Angola just across the way without going to Europe first. So is there that relationship developing, and could you relate that to the concepts of dependency as well?
Great, and then one last question.
I think there are so many thoughts about the relations between China and the United
My name is Karen, and I study global politics, and I am from Peru. And I might just make a simple question. And China has promised the U.S. to be the next superpower in the world, and has promised the U.S. to be outweighing them by 2025, probably. I would like to know, I mean, the success of China is important, especially because of this investments happening in Africa or South America, especially. And I'd like to know, what are your thoughts about how positive is this in terms of as China growing? How positive would be this for Latin America? How would you see this expansionist policies and politics in terms of growing China's economy?
Thank you for the interesting questions. So, Ariel, this issue, I think both sides have reached a new level of not putting all their eggs in one basket. Right? You see that with Argentina, still under the Macri government, with respect to at least the whole discourse of diversification. But you also see that, I think, on the part of China in Latin America. They realized, especially due to the case of Venezuela, now maybe Brazil is playing a role in that perception, that investing massively in a country, especially when there is some, back then, incipient instability, has major repercussions, right? And what they're doing in Venezuela is they're trying to hold steady, but they're watching very closely, and I think there are lots of Chinese stakeholders who are majorly, majorly concerned with what will happen there. And so this, I think, has affected their perception of the region, which 10 years ago I would characterize as, you know, compared to the Middle East, compared to a lot of parts of Africa, was seen as a very stable region, right? At least no armed conflicts, interstate, major armed conflicts. But they're starting to experience political instability in some of these countries. And so some of what I've been reading out of China about Latin America hammers home this point of, you know, potential political instability that then get back sort of to Nasser's point, that, you know, it's not just armed conflict that affects, right, risk and investment, it's also, you know, major regime changes and, you know, debates about the legitimacy of institutions, as in the case of Brazil, are institutions working? You know, when foreign actors, including Chinese investors, read this kind of thing. And by the way, the Chinese media has made leaps and strides over the last few years in terms of following Brazilian debates. You know, the way it comes across in the Chinese, the Renminbi, and the main state government papers, I think it's much more detailed. They have a much bigger team, at least in Brazil. So there is this mutual wariness that accompanies. I think it's kind of natural. The more you negotiate, the more you learn what happens and what doesn't. I forgot to mention, but you know, Brazil, like Argentina, even under the Lula government, forbade the direct purchase of land by foreign actors. And even though this is the legal, by the way, Nasser, the legal basis is, it doesn't discriminate against, for instance, Chinese companies. But it was clearly a response because of the timing. You know, I think the South Koreans tried to buy some land, and then the Chinese tried to buy some land, and then the law was passed. So I think it's part of the institutional learning on both sides. But on the Chinese side, there's a lot of concern about political instability.
But I think that, well, the power is in Chinese side, right? And probably Mercosur joined together will have more significant power to have better deals, or no?
If it comes together in a coherent way, because that was the project all along in the last 10 years, and instead what happened was, for several reasons, sometimes it was Argentina, sometimes it was Brazil, was paralysis, right? I mean, the deals that came out of it were, I think, with Israel, with Palestine, and with SADC. I don't even think it was implemented. These are tiny, these are almost insignificant streams. So they, you know, my sense is that they're watching closely, but things are, especially because of the situation in Brazil, very much up in the air. And Brazil and Argentina relations are also hard to read, right? We've had very mixed messages on both sides. So we don't know, and I don't know where that's going to go. But the, I think, you know, the answer is that what I followed in the Chinese news and the Chinese state speeches and documents, you can sense this new level of wariness. You know, let's wait things out a little bit rather than rush in as we did with Venezuela. But this gets back also to a point that Marco made about the ideological element, and which I didn't address. My sense is very lopsided, that right now some actors in South America especially, they have ideological intent in dealing with China, and they try to use it to legitimize, especially the so-called Bolivarian states. But I see China still being much more pragmatic. And you can see this because they deal across the board. There are, and this gets to Karen's point, there are some geopolitical competitions with the United States, especially in Central America and the Caribbean still concentrate, I don't know how many of the countries that still have formal relations with Taiwan, right? But with South America, you know, they really investigate possibilities in all of the countries, whether they're following more heterodox or more orthodox orientations. And in fact, with the case of Argentina and in Brazil, where you have, at least at the discursive level, right, disruption rather than continuity, you don't see the Chinese, oh, okay, well, in that case, let's pull out, right? You see this wariness, but it's much more to do with the general context. Rahul, on the northern, the sort of Suriname and Guyanas, there again, you know, there is a symmetry. I know the case of Suriname, and I've published about Brazil and China and Suriname, and that was one of the points of the article that I published, is that Brazil had all of these projects of opening up a highway that would lead from, it would basically, I think, bisect Suriname, and it would lead supposedly to Manaus. I don't think that was actually implemented, maybe just the northern bit of it. You know, this is what happened in Brazil, and we had major environmental, social, and economic consequences, a lot of them very negative. So it's very, it catches your attention that here's Brazil proposing a trans-Amazonic highway through pristine, practically pristine, right, except for the garimpeiros, the gold diggers, right? Otherwise pristine parts of the Amazon. So reproducing abroad problems that it encountered in the 1950s with the Big World Bank project. So clearly there are all kinds of asymmetries, I think especially with those countries. Angola is a bit of a different story because Angola is a very unequal society.